Okay, so are we back on?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, before we took a break, Mr. Cassano, instead of just taking the quick leap, or maybe we will take the quick leap from the late 05, early 06 decision to stop writing CDS on subprime to the July 07 Goldman collateral call, you know, is there anything that, you know, frankly comes to mind in terms of the multi-sector book, whether it's valuation, whether it's, types of product that you're writing CDS on, et cetera, growth, no growth, decision?
No, I think you, hedging. You know everything.
Okay. So let me ask you, when you guys decide, and we'll get to July in a second, when you make the decision in late 05, early 06 to stop writing CDS on subprime, you continue to write on non-prime, I guess, or non-subprime, all right? Is that fair?
Yes.
I mean, we do see some additional growth in the book. So, you know, as Al and I were talking about, asking you about earlier, you know, we did see in some of the stuff that we sampled, you know, that within the prime book, there was a fair amount of all-day and interest-only and no doc, low doc type loans. Did you guys know that even though you got out of the subprime, you were still writing on all day interest only low doc, no doc loans?
Did you say that to me about? Did you say option?
Yes, bonds? Yes, sir. I guess fundamental to the question is when you had the discussion about stopping on the subprime piece, was there ever any discussion around all day? And all day is also referred to as non-traditional mortgage products, specifically interest-only mortgages, payment option arm mortgages, etc.
Do you remember a conversation about that?
No.
And the decision to stop writing on subprime did not include a decision to stop writing on those types of products being all day interest-only.
Well, you know, my memory of this is we stopped writing on subprime, but we were still going forward on prime.
Okay.
And the reason I ask is because while you may have an RMBS deal, let's just say GSAMP 2006, blah, 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 that may have a 700 or a 695 weighted average FICO score, that deal could have significant amounts of interest-only mortgages, of payment option-only mortgages, and those have not performed very well. Maybe not as bad as subprime, but those have not performed very well. So that was just the basis of the question.
Okay.
So you've talked a little bit about being in New York and hearing about the Goldman call in July of 07 and not knowing what it's about. And we know from the documents that for, I believe, at least the whole time you were there until the end of March 2008, that doesn't look like the dispute was ever resolved to either party's satisfaction. So can you just generally first tell me about your role in the dispute, in the collateral call dispute between AIG, FP, and Goldman, and then I'll follow up with some specific questions.
I'm asking for the crown, just your role.
Right.
You're welcome to do it in chronological fashion, but however you want to do it.
I'm trying to think how you characterize my role. I think I was in the early part of the discussions. The Andrew and Alan and the team were working through the collateral calls with Goldman, and they were reporting to me what was going on. There was a time where I went to see Goldman to talk to him about that we had to figure out a way of getting this done correctly. And then, you know, but turned again back to Andrew and the team to manage the collateral call between the two of them, and they were reporting to me. So I think about my role as supervising that process. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, sure. So let me follow up. Like I said, the original Goldman call comes in at the end of July 2007. Who at AIG FP are the ones, you know, that are dealing with it on a day-to-day basis?
as best as I can remember, in so from July until let's go to mid-August, okay, it's Andrew is taking the lead with Alan, Frost, and those are the two. Mm. And to me, that's who I, from my perception, that's who's managing this process.
So are there folks from outside FP involved in the process, whether it's Habayeb or Dooley or Benzinger or any of those folks or anybody else?
They're informed. They know about it. Bill and Elias clearly know about the collateral call. But involved in the
negotiations?
No.
Okay. How did... Well, I know from the documents that FP disputes the initial call, and ultimately on August 10th, $450 million gets posted. But at that...
You know, there's more to the story than that. Well, there are actual reductions in the call.
Right. I know the 1.2 and... Right.
Okay.
Right. Just trying to shorten it up.
Yeah, no problem. Okay. You know?
So what I'm interested in is what your understanding was of, one, how Goldman was coming up with their valuations that supported the calls, how they were coming up with their marks, and how you guys were coming up with yours, whether they're marks or how you're coming up with your valuations.
We're just going to have to take this by segments, I think.
Sure, that's fine.
It sort of is some kind of disagreement, right? The first thing that happened when I think the initial call was 1.8, it may have been one that they came to us with, and it was like, well, what's this? You know, is it right? Right? And my guys had gone and gotten prices from, I believe, Merrill Lynch and maybe one other. And the prices that they had gotten for, if not the same but similar instruments, were much higher, which would have meant there was no margin call from then the prices that we were getting from Goldman. And they said that, you know, the view was, look, Goldman, we need to go back, and their view was that we need to go back and dispute this. This is, you know, they're just not right. And they had, so from July through this period of August, if it's August 10th, they went through and were arguing back and forth about it. And during this period, as Jim's pointed out, Goldman's number was being reduced, right? And so it was 1.8. I think there was, I have some memory at one point of it being 1.6, then the 1.2, then it was 600. And that then told me that there's something up with Goldman's numbers, right? And I had a conversation with the people, some during this process, with the people at, with the team at PwC about just the collateral call. And I remember my observations were, look, this market is just so difficult right now. Because, you know, we're in the early throes of the crisis, too, right? So the markets are roiling, to say the least, right? And I'm saying, look, people are having a really hard time. Even look at Goldman. And, you know, I posted them on what was going on. And even they, you know, Goldman's a pretty good outfit. They're having a hard time getting a handle on these numbers themselves. You know, and sort of, you know, having this argument with them about the size of the collateral call. So when you ask me how they were coming up with their number, I don't know what that side of it was. Mm-hmm. What I know is that on our side we had numbers from others, and they were just appreciably higher mm-hmm. than what the GS team had or was presenting.
Now, when you, in this, and I assume we're still in the July to August 10th segment, yeah. When you provided Goldman with, hey, look, we've got quotes from Merrill and maybe whoever else that are much higher than your numbers, what's their response?
I wasn't, as I said, I was sort of supervisor, so I'm not in the, I'm not on the telephone, I'm not talking to the team at Goldman.
Understanding that, I mean, are you getting reports from Mr. Forster, Mr. Frost about, hey, you know, we gave them these numbers and they're either saying okay or not okay, and here's why?
The report I was getting was the reductions. Mm-hmm. Right, look, they, you know, I would ask what's going on with the Goldman collateral call, right? Because it was significant and unusual, right? It's also slightly unusual that we have disputes with Goldman. It's not, you know, usually you can work these things out pretty quickly, and I, you know, obviously a big number. So I was asking, you know, periodically during this, you know, gee, what's going on here? And, you know, nothing moves quickly, as, you know, it's not like, well, here's the number and everybody's on the call the next day. And so it sort of drifts over periods of time, over a period of time. And the answer was, well, yeah, here and now the number is $1.2 billion. Well, what's going on? Well, they went back in and they looked at their numbers, you know, and they had to revise them. And now the number is 600. And, well, what's going on there? Well, they found out that they had this wrong and they were looking at that. And so it's a little hard to come to grips with it. At that, you know, what it was. But those were the kinds of reports I was getting.
So the prices you were getting from Merrill or whoever else it was from, were those prices that those folks would actually trade at?
You know, this is a good question. I don't know, all right? But I also don't know if Goldman would have traded at their prices.
Well, let me ask you that then, because this
I just
is,
don't know, because right. the market was seizing. My point is, Gary, sorry.
That's okay.
My point
Chris.
Is, Chris... At this time, is that this is the, you know, this is the first inkling that, boy, things are beginning to get off track here, and the market is really seizing up, right? LIBOR can't be, you can't invest and get a LIBOR return, right? Money markets are going crazy. The stock market's reacting violently. The commodity market is reacting violently. And so this, you know, this real, what's the word? I guess tension in the markets, right? And on what's going on. So I don't know, you know, these evaluation numbers, these are prices. People were giving them to us as prices. I don't know if I called and said, you know, deal on all of this, they would. I just don't know.
So let me, I mean, as you could probably imagine, we asked other AIG and Goldman people about this issue. And one of the things we are hearing from others are, on the one hand, you know, Goldman's marks were quote-unquote actionable marks and marks that they would trade at. That's what people have said. And people have said that a concern about AIG's prices were, in fact, they were third-party provided prices that were not actionable. In fact, they were just, would actually have disclaimers at the bottom saying we're not willing to trade at these prices. Does that simply jog memory bells in terms of some of the basis for the dispute between the valuations coming up by the two companies?
Okay. Not at this time that we're talking about.
Okay. I don't know that was going on in this segment that we're talking about. So generally, other than the July to August 10th time frame, were those issues
at
coming
the,
up?
And at the very end of my experience on this issue.
And that would be?
March of 08. Okay. They were then suddenly, well, we'll buy or sell. And then when we talked about that, it was, well, not the whole amount, not this part of the amount. So people, I know this statement you're making.
Mm-hmm.
I think the statement may have been made in good faith, but I think there's more to that statement that needs to be explored.
Okay.
But Goldman did make one statement contemporaneously that I think bears critically on the process on their side of the wall, because they did have one conversation.
Okay, so why don't you describe for me that conversation?
Coming on, right?
No, it's the Sherwood conversation.
Okay.
Covering.
We have heard about the meeting with Mr. Sherwood, but why don't you give us your recollection of that meeting and when it was?
It was in September, you know. Second week of September, third week of September, sometime around then of 07. Everybody had returned from, you know, Mike is based in London, so are we. European holidays, right? The world closes down at the end of August, and so everybody had returned from their holidays. I initiated the meeting because we needed to come to a dispute resolution mechanism here, right? This is, and as I said, it was unusual for us to have a dispute, and I, you know, the idea was to go over and sit with, and I asked Mike if we could come over and talk to him about it and figure out a way that, an objective way of going out and getting prices and figuring out how to value this stuff. And we had a, you know, I think a good discussion during the meeting about procedure to go out and get quotes on these deals, because, you know, the resolution mechanism here is to do dealer quotes. one of the things that Mike had told me, and I think he told me it over the phone, not in the meeting, when I was saying, you know, we need to go through this, and by the way, you guys, you know, I don't know what happened here with you guys, how you go from $1.8 billion to settling with us as a deposit for $450 million, but, you know, something wrong. And he says, look, we didn't cover ourselves in glory during this period. I understand that. And so we go to the meeting, and, you know, Mike's a very practical guy. And we have a discussion about how do we go out and get quotes, how do we do this together. You know, we have an argument about whether we use the bid, the mid, the offer side, right? And in illiquid markets, these numbers
are. When you say argument, are you being literal?
No, I mean, you know.
What discussion?
Discussion, right? A businessman's discussion over, gee, how should we go out and do this? You know, I don't remember which side, who was on which side, but I think they were saying we should go and get bids. We were saying, look, let's work on mids here. Let's do this. The agreement was, at the end of the meeting, was, okay, they're going to serve up document of procedures or whatever about us going out together, you know, on some size of these transactions, you know, not the, you know, we can't get quotes on $1 billion or something or whatever, so pick a size, a representative size of a variety of the transactions, and we'll go out and get these mid quotes, right? And so we went back and waited for them to come back with a procedure that they were going to, you know, that they were going to write up and how we were going to go and do it. And it never came, and it never came because they then began to change their minds, as was reported to me. I wasn't in the discussions then that said, no, we're going to use, I think they were on the bid, they wanted to use the bid side. They said, no, we're going to go back and use bid. And it was like, no, we're going to use mid. And no, we want to use these deals. And, you know, no, these were the deals we agreed, and that kind of thing. And so it somehow fell apart, and we never got to that point. And at the same time, so now we roll into late September. The Fed makes its first of its rate cuts. I think the world took a bit of a relief, right, thinking, all right, you know, the financial supervision is coming in to, you know, they're seeing the economic crisis that was beginning then. They're making accommodations. This is all probably good. And there was, through October, a bit of what's called a relief rally, right, that was going on. And so it sort of all went quiet during the period. So now where do we go?
So let me ask you, because when you say that, you know, they lower their demands and then the settlement for 450, but even the 450 at August 10, it's at least my understanding that while there's like a written standstill agreement at the time, it say both sides still disagree this is the right number. Is that your recollection also?
Sure, let's talk about that. So we're in this negotiated period where the number, Goldman's sitting there at $600 million. Andy and I both have holidays planned. Andrew and Foster and I have holidays planned that are coming up. My family's coming over, and we're going to go cycling through Germany and Austria. Andrew's family's going on holiday. We don't have this thing resolved. The market is still very choppy. My general view was, as I've said, it was unusual that we had these kinds of disputes. I said to Andrew, let's offer these guys, you know, and Andrew was saying, you know, they want to get this settled or whatever, and I said, well, we don't agree the number. I said, look, offer them a $300 million deposit. Tell them we'll make a deposit. We're not agreeing their numbers, but we'll make a deposit. It's good faith. Because it's unusual that we have these kinds of arguments. And this is, you know, Goldman's an important relationship. It's a business partner of ours in a lot of things that we were doing, and an important relationship. I said, offer them that. And let's and tell them that when we come back, that we have to sit down. I have to sit down with Mike Sherwood, and we need to come to a resolution here and figure out how we do this going forward and what we do. Right? I believe that that's what he offered. Came back and they said, well, okay, they'll do that, but they want 450. Right? Had a conversation with Andy about, well, if we give him 450, do we earn LIBOR on it? right? And as I said, it was also getting LIBOR as a return on your short-term cash was very difficult at this time because, you know, because of the kerfuffles in the market, right? Money, short-term rates had dropped to the floor, right? And so he was an opportunity, reasonable return on our investment. All right, and Goldman's a good credit. So let's go ahead and do that.
Sure, posted more.
Could have. All right, and good point. And with the provision that we go and do this, now that we take this up when we come back. Now, I think it's Goldman that served up this document that you're referring to. I don't think it was us. Mm-hmm. I know the document now, and the document says that this is an indication that either one of us, right? I think the document says this is not collateral for these deals or something. This is, you know, recognize a deposit, and neither one of us are agreeing to each other's pricing or something to that effect, okay. Right?
So, you mentioned that, as you said, the Fed cut. Market has a little relief rally and things go quiet for a while. We know from the documents that on November 23rd, you guys post another $1.5 billion to Goldman.
November
23rd. So I suspect that's probably somewhat of a jog some memory bell. So take me through that segment of what's going on when I take it the relief rally ends and suddenly Goldman's asking for more money.
Right. Okay, so the November 23rd is kind of throwing me for a loop because I think about October 30th, November 1st.
Okay, well, take me to what you recall.
Okay, is when Mike calls me. That's why I stopped where I did.
Sure.
I mean, right, so then Mike calls, Mike Sherwood gives me a call to give me a heads up. They're running their month-end numbers, and what he's seeing is that their collateral call has gone up to $3 million. And I said, I haven't seen anything like that in the market. You know, and I'm, from my perspective, I'm looking, and as I stated, there was this relief rally and all this good stuff, right? And I said, all right, well, you know, thanks for the call, and, you know, we're going to have to talk, but I'm going to have to understand how you came up with this number. And
at this point, is it from $600 million to $3 billion? Is that the jump, or is there something in between?
No, this is the next call.
Well, when you remember these daily things that kept you understand that, right?
Right.
The call actually does increase in terms of the documentation, but the contract says you can ignore those.
Or
so
this is.
I will tell you, our records indicate that from November 1st to November 2nd, the call goes from $1 billion to $2.8 billion. That sounds consistent with your timing and somewhat consistent with the amounts you're talking about.
Okay, but but you know, my experience, right? That's what we're talking about here. So, I'm not looking at these whatever these things are that Jim says that are coming into the office and those kinds of things that are going into Westport. We have this agreement that says we're in standstill mode, and my thinking is we're working on a long-term solution of some sort with GS, right? And I think in light of that, that's why Mike is calling me with the heads up, right? Because he recognizes the same thing. We have this standstill and all this. Let me call Joe and let him know what we're seeing and what we're talking about here. And so that's where. And so, I'm probably splitting hairs. My experience is that the call went from the last thing that we did, which was the deposit, mm-hmm. to the $3 billion on the end of October there. Indication, and then, you know, when that happened, you know, obviously I told the people at AIG about it, and we waited for, because I didn't have the numbers from Mike then, and we waited for Mike to send in the numbers.
So when you get told that, hey, our mark's going up to $3 billion, what's the response?
Focus on what Mike said during that call and the conversation that you had for a second.
All right. You got to bear with me on my memory here.
That's fine.
But I think this is the call where I tell Mike, look, we're not going to pay that amount. Something to that effect. You know we're not paying three, you know. And he says, yeah, we didn't think you would. And the conversation was, look, we need to understand where your numbers are coming from. And I think this is the conversation where Mike says to me, look, early on, we may have been ahead of everybody else, but we now are seeing the market come our way. Right? And I said, well, look, that's, you know, the market's not supposed to come your way. It's what the market is. And I said, look, you know, send me the details, but we're going to have our team sit down and discuss how you guys are getting these numbers and how we're getting the numbers, you know, and take a hard look at this. And he was, you know, very agreeable to that. He said, yeah, I think that's right. I think we have to do that.
Let me go back. I apologize. Back to your initial conversation with Mr. Sherwood after the July 07 call, and I believe you said something like, look, I know we didn't cover ourselves in glory or whatever
during
it was,
the negotiations.
But can you provide a little bit more color on that? I mean, we, like you said, I mean, we've seen the documents too, the original call going from 1.8 to 1.2, and we see eventually the 450 posted. I mean, did Mr. Sherwood or anyone else at Goldman ever say our marks were wrong? Or did they just say the market changed and so our marks went down?
I don't remember either of those statements. My recollection of the conversation is I complained about, gee, Mike, you know, you guys were all over the place on this, right? You call it 1.8, you know, you lower the call to 1.2 to 600, you know, and so, I mean, that was the response, is, look, we didn't cover ourselves in glory on this.
Let me ask you something somewhat off point. Do you recall in the May, I think the June 07 time frame, when the Bear Stearns hedge funds announced a fairly substantial decline in the net asset value of their funds?
I remember the Bear Stearns event as an event. I mean, I don't remember this the way you're... I don't remember the specifics. I mean, okay.
There was a reduction in their April 07 NAV from about a minus 6.75 to a minus 19%. I'll just represent that
okay,
to you.
Right.
And I think that revised decline in the April NAV gets announced like on June 7th. And really my first question is, does that... Okay. Okay, so let's go back.
I'm sorry, is there some connection between the Bear Stearns thing and the change in the Goldman collateral calls? Because I don't think the market went up between their initial collateral call on the 27th and the settlement on August 10th, right? So I just think we need to know the answer to this. If your hypothesis was, yeah, it changed, but it changed because the market improved and prices got better, that's not my understanding of the market.
No, it's just completely separate topic question. Okay, so when Mr. Sherwood, when you tell him that they're all over the place, is that the extent of it?
Conversations with Mike are fairly, pretty short conversations.
Okay, so then when we're in the early November time frame, and you get the heads up, presumably before November 2nd anyway, since that's when the $2.8 billion call comes in, at least according to documentation, provide more color, if you can, on his statement, look, we see the market coming our way. Maybe
I don't mean to. You haven't talked to Mike. There's not a lot of words.
Okay. No, but what he's asking you is, what did you take that to mean? How did you interpret that when he said those words to you, the market's coming our way? What way is that?
Oh, that somehow Goldman's numbers were lower, and now the market's catching up to where Goldman, and other people are pricing their books down where Goldman is. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
And what I'm getting at with it, I think your counsel...
Everybody seems to understand more than I do.
Did you take that as an implicit admission that the prior marks were too low?
Yes.
And did you have any discussions with Mr. Sherwood or anyone else at Goldman, since Mr. Sherwood is apparently a man of few words, about the implicit admission that the prior marks were too low?
No.
Did
not that I remember, right?
Did you take it to mean anything about Goldman's overall position with respect to the subprime market?
At this point, no.
Which, of course, begs the question. At some point.
Yeah. Well, there was a point down the road where Mr. Blankfein and Mr. Vanier at two different times, Mr. Blankfein and then announced that they were short, right? There's this, I don't know if it was a Merrill Lynch investor conference or a Lehman investment conference in New York, and, you know, this is down the road a bit. This is November, later November, and or maybe even in December or something, where he announced that the firm was short. And you know, because, you know, people, investors were asking, analysts were asking them, well, how are you doing during the crisis and stuff? And so, you know, at that point in time, you hear from them and go, well, maybe this is what's happening.
Well, let me ask you, because I believe shortly they actually announced, in relative terms, anyway, some pretty good 3Q07 numbers that was actually followed by some articles in the financial press, including, I think, an article in Fortune, How Goldman Defies Gravity, you know, that was about how they were reporting good earnings and for 3Q07 compared to other firms on the street. Does that, and I think that article came out in, I want to say, the September time frame. Does that jog memory bells about hearing Goldman or others, Goldman or anybody at Goldman, saying that they were net short or short?
Look, here and now, and I'm, you know, as I think about this, it's that I don't remember this article, and, you know, people are always, every time Goldman announced their earnings, they're always doing well, and there was always articles about, gee, these guys, what is, you know, and things. But I have this recollection that Blankfein made this announcement that, you know, that they were short in the market while we were having these. We were trying to get to this discovery point of, because where we're headed here is we were trying to find out from them, what are you doing? How are you going about pricing these things, right? And I think Andrew and other members of my team, and I think, you know, Pierre and maybe James Bridgewater, another new products guy, sure, right, quant person, and we're on having calls with the team at Goldman, right? And, you know, and I'm sorry, my dates aren't very precise, but it's probably in, part of it is in this November period, where they're talking about what they're doing and how are they coming up with these prices.
But you know the event. When was it specifically that you found out for the first time the methodology that they claimed that they were using in order to calculate on their side of the wall? Where were you?
Well, I was in the States, and
for
Andy,
what?
I was on the Investor Roadshows.
So we know that was from the 11th to
right,
the 18th, roughly.
Right, and Andy had...
And just so the tape's clear, the 11th to the 18th of...
November.
Thank you.
Right, sorry. And I was asking Andy about what it was they were doing, and asking him, did you have the call with Lehman? Did you have the call with Goldman? Did you go through the you know, and stuff? And he had explained to me that they did. And then he said, well, they had this way of doing it, and there was a discussion about leakage, and I didn't understand what it was, right? And I said, what's leakage? And how they go about discounting some of the or haircutting the valuations within the portfolios and all those things. But
do you mind if I lead the witness just a little bit to finish the chronology, and then you can ask whatever you want, because there may be a piece in there that you're not aware of.
Okay.
After you get back to the States, do you have them conduct an analysis based
yes.
on the way in
right,
which Goldman claimed
right. I didn't
said
we were
that
up
we're
to this yet, but
yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay. So Andy tells me what they're doing. We're near the end of November now, right? We have, and we've crossed the... There's some point here where we've crossed the one of your benchmark points, right? We did increase the deposit. You have the date.
It's on November
23rd.
Okay, so we increased the deposit. So now they have, I think, $2 billion
right.
As a deposit, right, in their books. And I come back from the roadshow. We're going to the AIG Roadshow, so we're in late November. And my team now has the methodology that Goldman is using. We use the Goldman methodology with what we see as the market prices, and even using the way they do it, we think we should be calling back collateral from them, right? That And if I have my numbers in my head right, I think we were asking them to return $1.4 billion of that $2 billion number, because using their methodology, which they had given to us, we think they were overstating their values. And okay, does that make sense?
It does. And I will tell you that, and maybe there's stuff in between here that I don't know about, but I certainly see a January 16th, 2008 email that you send to Mr. Sherwood with two attachments, one a listing of each party's marks, values,
right.
And then a letter saying give us back $1.1 billion of what we posted. I don't know. Is that what you were recalling? So there's something before then. Well, go. Why don't you go ahead, Ms. Before you.
But you do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, well, you can go ahead. I had a question to go backwards. Go ahead. But yes,
you guys have
did send him a letter.
No,
which
we
have.
Donna Norman, Donna
Joe Casano.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
We do have the letter that's 1 week later asking for them to send back the $1.55
million. Okay, thank you.
But can I ask a question? How did the decision get made, and who made it to send the additional $1.5 billion on November 23rd? Because you called for it back about 1 week later.
Right. Okay. Let me just. During this period, I'm in the States, and I'm doing this roadshow with AIG. Had this idea that we should go out and talk to the investors right after the earnings call had come out about the performance of the portfolio and the major investors. And so I was with Bill at the time, Bill Dooley. I think Bill was there, Kevin was there, and Elias, Kevin McGinn and Elias Javier were on the roadshow with us. And we were meeting some of the larger investors in the company in California and Massachusetts and New York and New Jersey. During that period, Andy called me and said that Goldman's looking for us to settle this call that Ray and things. We've been having these discussions with them, and they're offering whatever it is, 1.5, I guess, was the number. And I had a conversation with Bill, and Andy was saying, look, I think we should go ahead and do this, and we can go and work out the rest of the details with them and, you know, continue to figure out where this all is. And I was saying to him, why don't we just go to the dealer poll? Right? Because, you know, for me, one of the issues here was dealer poll was the right thing, was what we should do, right? And I think we were just on two different sides of this coin. Andy was thinking, look, we should do this and work out the negotiated solution with Goldman and just keep going through it, you know, getting a return on our investment and all that. So I went to Bill and I explained this all to Bill. Now, I have a recollection that I did this with Bill in a lobby of a hotel in Boston during this period, right? It could have been I did it on a phone or something like that, but that's my memory of this conversation. And I said to Bill that, look, here's what we should do. And I said, look, Andy thinks we should agree this, temporary, figure out a longer-term solution still. You know, we have the cash to do it. We should go ahead and do it. Frankly, Bill, I think we should go out to the dealer poll. Going to the dealer poll is going to be, you know, it's going to be messy. It's going to, you know, and stuff. And Bill's view is we should avoid basically airing the dirty laundry. And why don't we just go for the settlement and work out the solutions too? So that's what we did. So
did you have any understanding as to whether the settlement had any analysis behind it, or was it just a rote compromise?
I think it's just one of the, you know, think about the number was $3 billion and it's 1.5, something like that.
So it wasn't based on any analysis by AIG, to your knowledge, that
not that I know
that was a better
right.
place to market.
Right.
So a week later, you asked for it back.
Well, then I get back to the...
And actually, let me stop you, because you had mentioned that, I think you mentioned, or maybe it was Jim, that they had provided
like
you...
Like one.
typer of the transcript will know. But you had mentioned they had provided, you know, how they had come up with their marks, and you guys had used that to figure out that you guys thought you were entitled to 1.4 back.
Okay.
What did they give you? I mean, that told you how they were coming up with their marks.
I think you need to talk to... I'm not going to be able to be specific on this,
okay.
What exactly what it was. My team came to me with what they said was, here's the methodology that Goldman's using. Here's how they're calculating it. Here's how they come up with this leakage number. This is what the prices are that they've used, and here's how they came up with the collateral. So when I sat with my team, and so Pierre McCottis, Andy Foster, and James, they were telling me, and James Bridgewater, they were telling me, this is the methodology that Goldman used. So I think, and they were in the phone calls with the, so I think you need to get to the detail of what it was. You need to talk, ask them the question, if you don't mind.
Okay. So is it that analysis of what they provide you that leads to the week later, give me my money back letter, for lack of a better term?
Well, that's what the letter said, right? Yes, I'm sort of seeing the spreadsheet in front of me, right? It was a spreadsheet that had sort of a side-by-side calculation. This is the calculation. This is what we think is using our prices. And again, I think it was Pierre that was running this analysis. And that was the analysis that we used to request the money back.
Okay.
So this is in that... So we're near the end of November now, right? The date...
It's about November 30th,
right.
I think we asked for that.
So now there's a period where I'm asking my team, well, what's going on? We've asked for our money back. Where is it? And stuff. And they're saying, well, Goldman's not agreeing, and somebody's going, we're getting near the holidays, and they're going on holiday or something like that. I said, look, this isn't cricket. I spoke with...
meaning that it wasn't kosher, right?
Right, here in New York,
okay.
Or in Washington,
right.
It wasn't kosher.
Okay.
Right?
I wasn't familiar with that expression. So.
Yeah, you're not playing by the rules.
Yeah.
And, we've been working with you guys in good spirit and all that. We want our money back. So during this period, and just the dates are all sort of... It's a big, long continuum for me, right? I have another conversation with Mike, and I say, Mike, we sent this to you. What are you guys doing on this and stuff? And he said, look, I'm working on it. And at this point, Mike presents himself to me, which I think was fair, is, look, I'm trying to be an honest broker in this. So, and I say, what? He says, I'm not the ultimate decision maker here. I've got to check with the CFO. And I said, well, should I be talking to him about all of this? And... He said, look, I'm trying to work for you guys. Because, again, it's this business, right? We all have a positive business relationship. We're all working towards the same thing. And so I said, okay, appreciate that. But I decided that I should call Mr. Veneer. And so I did. And explained to him that, we're not, what's going on here and all that. And he said something to me like, well, I'm hearing from my guys that your prices are much lower than, are higher than what others are what they're seeing in the market. And I said, look, we got to resolve this. Can you send this all to me? And then I get a letter from them. I think we get a letter, rather, from a fellow named Andy Dabbleman.
Okay.
Right.
He's the sales guy on Goldman's side. Right.
Sort of the Al Frost counterpart, I guess, right?
Right.
And... Dabbleman sends us a letter that says that these are the prices they're using, right? On a subset of the deal. Maybe it was the whole deals or whatever, right? And so, again, we take that, and that's what's the, So now we're on, I think, we're going on holiday. Christmas is coming up, right? It's December 20th or something like that. So I send them a note saying a brief outline of what we looked at it really quickly. So you've seen that note, right?
Yes.
And tell them that, look, we got to pick this up when we come back from holiday. And when we, we'll do further analysis on it or whatever. And so we come back from holiday, and that, I think, Chris, is the letter that you're referring to.
And you refer to it as a follow-up to that December email.
Right.
Sent.
Okay.
So right.
And so that's the general discourse. So if I boil this down, you know, there's the initial give and take on, and negotiation in the July-August period and the placing of the deposit. Not a whole lot goes, you know, there's the meeting that says we're going to figure out how we're going to mark these things to market, right? And let's go do that. That plan doesn't come together. There's then a margin call that happens in the end of October, beginning of November, that's an increase. We then say, look, we got to get down to it and figure out what's going, what you guys are doing here. Finally, by the end of November, we have a clear picture of how Goldman Sachs is doing the analysis. But even with their analysis, we're still coming out with higher valuations, lower margin calls using their analysis. Then we move to, and now we ask for our money back, your words, right? Give me my money back on that, based on that analysis. And then there is nothing happening. Call again to Goldman Sachs and say, this time to both Sherwood and to Vanir at different times, say, where are we on this? Get another letter from Goldman explaining what the pricing is. Again, looking at that analysis, and the letter is evidence of what our analysis is, right? We're using your numbers, changes in bid and offers, and you know, here's where we see things. Still, you owe us money back, right? It's not maybe the 1.4 anymore. It's another, was it 1.1 that we were asking for back right. then at that point? As of, and so then when we return after the holiday break, and we get to our analysis there, we send another letter to them saying, where is the money? You know, here's what you owe us. Here's what our analysis is.
Are you escalating this at all during this time period to Bensinger or Sullivan?
Everybody at AIG knows exactly what I'm doing during this process. Well, I'm sorry, when I say everybody. Bill Dooley, Steve Bensinger, and Bob Lewis.
And did any of them have discussions with people at Goldman?
I believe Steve, because, you know, look, this is becoming a bigger deal in my mind, right? It's a big number, you know, it's going on for a long time. And I'll keep coming back to this, but Goldman's a big relationship all right. over the company and stuff. I want to make sure everybody's aware, right? You know, look, one of the great things you got to do in this world is make sure everybody's informed. And so I'm asking Steve to call David and talk to Mr. Vanir and say, look, you know, just find out what's going on. See where we are on all of this. And I think there may even, you know, there's probably an email that you have to me asking Steve if he's talked to him at some point.
Do you care to hear about the follow-up that he gets from Steve Bensinger about the conversation?
Sure.
Or any conversation
take
with Sullivan?
Take me through it.
Give me a second. So Steve talks to me about the conversation that he had. So he finally does talk to David. Similar kind of conversation to what I had with David. David seeing lower numbers and what others see his people are telling him that our numbers are higher than what they see. And I'm missing a point here because it's there's something about this conversation I'm missing now.
When was this about?
It's all in this time frame of late December, early January. It's in this frame of that he has this conversation with them. Oh, and again, there's a phrase that gets repeated in this conversation, which is a phrase that Mike had used too, and you know, firms can be cultural in their presentations, but we may have been ahead of the market, but the market's coming our way. And now we hear that same echo of a phrase from two different people in the institution. And again, it's like, well, what is this? That the market is coming your way. You know, look, and I'm sitting there saying, I don't, you know, I'm disagreeing with the numbers, and you know, are you pushing the market? Are you driving the market? Are you making the market? Because remember, at this point in time, we are still in, you know, Jim hates this word, opaque, opacity, illiquid. You know, this is, the market is muck and mire, right? There's nothing trading. And, you know, I don't, my general view is this is not a trading market. This is not a market where you can call up even by appointment and get people to give quotes. And on the instruments that we own, we know they're not trading, right? The things that we're covering, because, you know, we don't need to go into this, but there's a disconnect between, you know, there's the valuation of our derivative, and then there's what was the convention in the collateral calls, which talked about using the underlying bond, right? And there's the difference, you know, I hold a firm belief that there is a huge difference between marking, valuing a credit derivative versus what a bond value might be because of the liquidity involved in it.
Those dreaded two words.
I think you guys understand what happens if
negative
you go to the we'll get there, I'm sure. If you go to the dealer pool and you can't get actionable prices, what then happens under the contracts? Right?
Court, right?
No.
Well, eventually, that's right, what eventually would happen, right? Because you if you go to a dealer poll, and then nobody's, you know, you're down to one quote, which would, you know, is possible, then it's broken, right? And so then you're back to a negotiating table, really. And I think in the context of a Goldman Sachs issue, we wouldn't be in court; we'd be at a negotiating table. But the negotiating table now changes, because you take all this nonsense away about, oh, well, we have prices, actionable prices. Mm-hmm. And you say, what are you talking about, actionable prices? Because there are no quotes, right? So, and,
except
you
know, theirs.
No. That's not the way it works.
But that's, it's progress.
I understand.
Yeah.
I get the distinction.
Okay. Right. So there's only one man in the world who's standing up to give an actionable price. So they've become the lender of last resort.
Right. I understand.
Okay. Just looking for some acquiescence.
can we just take a two-minute bathroom break?
Sure.